you're listening to my audio essay titled, Why Won't the Sari Fit Me? Growing up as a queer brown immigrant child in Singapore who was relatively plus sized, I've never draped this beautiful piece of fabric around my body long enough or to feel good in it. And trust me, my mother has tried. She would get me and my sister ready 3 hours before any function, wedding or Diwali party and try to drape this itchy but very lavish piece of fabric around our body. We were not having it. The audio you just listened to at the intro was my sister crying, "It's too hot. I don't want to do this." That was her being fitted into a sari by my mother, but her throwing a tantrum and me very evilly laughing at the side. It is a shame, really, that none of us have felt comfortable in the sari, because my earliest memories of being in India is with my mother in a sari shop looking through the 24 beautiful types of Bengali saris, including Gaurud, Tant, Dhakai. They're all made from different regions in India, embodying the location, the people, the culture, the celebrations. After all, sari is the quintessential symbol of Indian femininity, and is all so it's a shame that I've always been quite at odds with it. My relationship with the sari has really stifled my relationship with Indian femininity as a whole. Am I too modern for the sari? Is the sari too modern for me? This audio essay will explore the role of the sari in constructing Indian femininity through coarse concepts such as the politics of recognition, class and caste, spectacularization in a very non-Western, non-white context, post-feminism, neoliberalism, and also politicized femininity and Hindu nationalism. But more importantly, this audio essay will explore my relationship with the sari, but at large, my relationship with Indian femininity. So I hope you enjoy. Part 1. Which sari can I wear? The audio you just listened to is that of the women in my family coming together to have a quote-unquote light discussion about everything from town affairs to the price of milk to how our government is garbage after their afternoon lunch. This is a daily ritual of my family back in India. There's one distinct thing about the video, though. You can recognize the class and caste status of the women through the saris that they're wearing. The women, upper caste women, who are wearing vibrantly colored saris with thin borders, intricate designs, and made out of expensive silk material. Meanwhile, the lower caste women are wearing saris that are made out of breathable material, have thick borders and simple patterns. These are more durable saris as well. And this relates to Beverly Skeggs' argument about the politics of recognition in the toilet paper, femininity, class, and misrecognition. She argues that there are consequences of, quote, institutionalized patterns of interpretation and evaluation that constitute one as comparatively unworthy of respect or esteem. To be recognized is also dependent on symbolic systems of knowledge and evaluation to which we have access and through which we recognize other. End quote. The sari essentially becomes the symbol of recognition. Every time I bend down to receive blessings from my relatives, I recognize them through the saris that they're wearing. This is because I cannot touch the feet of my lower caste aunties to receive blessings from them. When I was younger, I often used to misrecognize the saris and by mistake touch my lower caste aunties' feet. That would yield a lot of shame and embarrassment. And as Skeggs argues, there is serious consequences to the misrecognition, as afterwards they would have to apologize to me and touch my feet instead. The caste-based distinction, therefore, was extremely distinct through the saris that we were wearing. The lower caste aunties who wore the durable saris were also masculinized in their roles. Their access to the quote-unquote beautiful Indian femininity was limited. Traditionally, the Skeggs also makes this argument about working class women, as they she projects that, quote, working class women were also involved in forms of labor that prevented femininity, in brackets, appearance and characteristics, from ever being a possibility. The working class women, the lower caste women in my hometown, go and do agricultural work, which is extremely taxing and has a type of work that requires a long sustained period under the sun. Therefore, their access to aesthetic whitening Indian femininity is limited. They would also, the encoding of class and caste, therefore, would be done through the symbolic sari, as you would recognize who is doing the agricultural work, which is often looked as a more masculinized form of work compared to upper caste women doing more household labor. Going into the big city to go for a job interview or access other services, going to festivities and functions, or tapping into other cultural capital alongside upper class women would require my lower caste aunties to tap into the little access they have to femininity. They would have to get ready on the side, using more beauty products, investing in more beauty products, in order to be able to attend these functions or go into the city for go into the big city to access healthcare services or job interviews, etc. And therefore, Skeggs' argument for working class women accessing cultural capital also plays into the very interpretive sense here. Therefore, when I think about which sari I will be wearing in my hometown in India, it reminds me of the deeply entrenched caste and class system, which also is related to the division of labor, and my function as an Indian feminine woman in my hometown, doing labor as through the sari I wear. Part 2. But Ma, do I even have to wear a sari? The audio you just listened to is that of Durga Puja being celebrated in my hometown. In the video you cannot see is a line of Indian women, my aunties, standing in a circle and blowing conch to pray worship to Goddess Durga. They all have white saris on, which is thickly lined with a very beautiful red border. And this is known as Lal Par Shari. This is the quintessential symbol of the Bengali woman. And Durga Puja spans over 10 days. And for Bengalis, it's greater than Diwali itself. However, the sari of the Bengali women and its symbolic significance also point to the Hindu nationalist construct of Indian femininity. India is one of the more secular countries in the world and has the second largest Muslim population. However, Indian femininity is constructed within the woman who wears the sari and worships to goddess that are specifically Hindu. The Indian Prime Minister, a self-proclaimed Hindu nationalist, Prime Minister Modi, few weeks after taking office, announced his Make It in India campaign that aimed to yield dominant manufacturing and production within the country itself. Amongst this production was the production of Banarasi sari made by weavers who are mostly from the poor Muslim population. Even though the Make It in India campaign was greatly successful in increasing the demand for Banarasi sari both internationally and domestically, Indian weavers who were Muslim and poor got almost little to no economic benefit from it. And this speaks to the rigid Hindu-centric and Islamophobic structure of our political regime and the political party itself. More interestingly, rape and defilement of women, of Indian women, is always projected through the damage of sari. Take the Nirbhaya case study in 2012, for example, the one that got made into the documentary known as India's Daughter, which shed a light on the increasing amount of rape cases that is occurring in India. The poster of that documentary was of Indian women in saris protesting the defilement of India's quote-unquote daughter. This echoes Sikata Banerjee's argument in Politicized Femininity and Masculine Nationalism, where she projects that women, Indian women, more specifically, play the role of border guard. And with the female body is where masculine nationalism is also plays out. The iconic representations of quote-unquote wife, mother, and young virgin, and in Nirbhaya's case, the daughter, is all seen as the nation that it needs to be protected. And since the nation is mapped onto Hindu-centric ideals, now the nation wears a sari, and rape is seen as a defilement of the borders of the nation. And therefore, much of the discourse around sexual assault and rape also centers the defilement of the sari. Sikata Banerjee also projects Gandhi's ideals of women taking part in political activism and in women's rights. She says that Gandhi, quote unquote, insisted that women should come out onto the streets only when they had finished their household duties and received permission of their guardians. In public, they were supposed to remain a chaste, non-violent, self-sacrificing image of mother and wife, becoming the moral compass of the Indian nationalist movement. And this speaks to much of the morality and the discourse that plays out within sexual violence and rape that happens in India, which protects about protecting the daughter, protecting the mother, not defiling the chaste body, as India tries to map their nation onto Bharatma, which relates into, which translates into Mother India. So when I ask my mother if it's necessary for me to wear a sari, she will absolutely say yes, because that is the projection of the Indian morality, the Indian nationalism, the purity, and the patriotic sentiments. Part 3. Where can I find a cool sari? The audio you just listened to is that of Diwali being celebrated back in my hometown. which was sent to me by my uncle. And in the video, you can see Indian women from every age range, specifically Bengali women, dancing to the song Dhaka Shadi, which means sari from Dhaka, a very popular pop Bengali song at the moment, just wearing these dazzling, beautiful Bengali saris and dancing to the pop song. And this gives me a lot of joy because it echoes Dozer Kun's arguments about spectacularization of non-white femininity, where Indian women are constantly now transcending the binary of subject and object, empowered, disempowered, traditional and modernity. Indian women exist within the times of now, and they are doing so not by mimicking Western white modernity, but rather reconciling tradition and modernity and living with a style of doing modernity within the Indian style. And this is something I have been noticing within the last 11 years that I have attended Diwali functions within in my apartment in Singapore as well, where there has been a trend, especially in fashion, of reconciling tradition and modernity within, especially amongst young Indian women, with traditional sari and kurti designs. I think Dozer Kun's argument about location also comes into play here, because the way that young Indian girls fashion themselves within in West Bengal is very different from how young Indian girls, especially the daughters of expats, for example, fashion themselves in Singapore. There is a clear divide within the regions of India, and there's a clear divide in caste, and there's a clear divide in culture and language too. The example of Sabyasachi is also extremely important when we talk about reconcilement and the transcending of the traditional modernity boundaries. Dozer Kun talks about Ransom Kuti, who was fashioning a materially distinct African modernity by the way of tradition, quote unquote. And this is something that Sabyasachi does too, by projecting how modernity can be designed within a non-European context, and tradition and the fact that tradition and modernity are not opposed, sequential or teleological. Sabyasachi is a line of Indian brand clothing, especially for bridal wear and festive wear, founded by Sabyasachi Mukherjee in 1999 from Kolkata, India. This range of bridal wear became extremely popular, especially with the young population and young Indian celebrities such as Deepika Padukone, Anushka Sharma and Priyanka Chopra have been seen in international media wearing Sabyasachi's clothing. And the unique standpoint of Sabyasachi's clothing that is because it integrates chic and contemporary design with understated blended with rich Indian textiles, which are very traditionally hand-loomed and hand-weaved. And this is the selling point of Sabyasachi. However, as Dozer Kun says that in her book about Nigerian women in Lagos being ultra uber rich, and and the fashioning sort of signals a global sisterhood of chic consumerist and individualistically minded women who find freedom through consumption, and they hence pointing forth to neoliberalism and global capitalism. This is also true for Indian women who especially consume Sabyasachi, because that is intensely expensive and can only be afforded by the uber rich, or Dozer Kun's words, ultra privileged. So even the transcending of the binary of tradition and modernity is related to very class solidarity, where women within lower class, and as we have discussed, caste status, do not have access to such transcendence through fashioning. So the answer of where a guy can find a cool sari relies really upon capitalist consumption and neoliberalist assumptions of fashioning, as well, which has been steeped into the Indian modern femininity. I would just like to pose a question to my mom. Ma, can I wear your sari for graduation? I am done trying to fit into the sari or have the sari fit me. I'm done trying to be a passive participant in the process of draping a sari. I want to reclaim the sari, reclaim this beautiful piece of fabric, reclaim this cultural capital. And I want to work in relationship with the sari to construct and embody and strengthen my own brown femininity.